Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
You like Huey Lewis in the news?
They're okay.
Their early work was a little too new wave for my taste. But when sports came out in 83, I think they really came into their own, commercially and artistically. The whole album has a clear, crisp sound. And a new sheen of consummate professionalism that really gives the songs a big boost. He's been compared to Elvis Costello, but I think Huey has a far more bitter, cynical sense of humor.
Hey, Albert.
Yes, Alan?
Why are there copies of the style section all over the place? Do you have a dog? A little chow or something?
No, Helen.
Is that a raincoat?
Yes, it is. Hey, Paul!
Good afternoon to you. It is 22 minutes after the hour of 1 in this, the month of August in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, the home of quality. My name is Rick Emerson. Thank you for joining us. It is Wednesday. It's 503-505-6964. If you would like to join us today, 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. You can also email Dawn Taylor if you like. Dawn@rickemerson.com. And the chat box is up and running at rickemerson.com, the website. All right, so phone on now. All right, there we go. Hello, Dawn Taylor. How are you in this... on this fine Wednesday?
Nah, I'm just peachy.
Are you, in fact, peachy?
Sure.
Here's what's going to make even peachier. Why don't you tell the fine people what news stories await them? Because I swear to God, I gotta get down on my hands and knees here. Uh-huh. And get underneath the table, because I think I kicked out a power cable.
Okay.
That I don't want to have kicked out. So you can just take as much time as you need to talk about what might be coming up in the world of news. Don't mind me. I'll just be down here.
Well,
yes?
Let's see.
No, it's fascinating, really.
California will be ruling today on same-sex marriage.
Really?
Yep. A woman was injured during a local Gallagher show. And one of our longest-running independent rock nightclubs here in Portland is going to be closing its doors.
Hey, fantastic. And you know what's great is that timed out perfectly. All right, I got the thing plugged back in. All right, there you go. This is just how real radio stations operate, and I'm not even kidding, by the way. Except that here, I can actually get down and I can fix the thing. Real radio station, they cleverly got big panels bolted up and then soldered together and then welded into place so that you can't ever actually access the thing that you need to access to fix whatever it is that's wrong. All right. What did you say about Gallagher being gay?
No, a woman was injured during a local... Gallagher show.
But not because he's gay. Him probably, being gay has nothing to do with this. It has his Gallagher's gayness, which is obvious to everyone.
No. Neither did his seething anger, apparently.
He's just a bastard, too.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to start with Gallagher. I hadn't anticipated beginning today's program with a discussion of the man himself, but I... And I'll just hold off for just a second here because we can talk about some other things that are coming up. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be joining us today. That's on the horizon. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week, who apparently is a sporting brand new, exciting look, according to Don Taylor. You said that he had sort of a champ kind thing going on.
More like Paul Rudd in Anchorman, the sideburns and the mustache. I can't remember the name of his character.
Oh, and I knew it. I knew it until you asked me. And now all I remember is his testicles are named Dr. James Westfall and Kenneth Noisewater. That's it. Well, in any event. So Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will join us. We'll talk about what's going on in Portland and in their fine newspaper. Mr. Dan Hanico from Powell's Books will be on the program later on today. He'll be in the studio to talk about the world of classic children's literature as well as crossover books. Because the thing is, There used to be, I think there used to be an emphasis on this, and then it went away, but now it has come back, which is the idea of manufacturing a kind of entertainment for children that functions equally well for adults. And we've talked a lot about how the Warner Brothers cartoons, were presumably made for children, but as time went on, they became more and more of a multi-generational product, not unlike The Simpsons, for example, or Mad Magazine. And I think we went through a period like in the 80s and the 90s where things were hyper specialized and there was like crap that was just for kids and crap that was just for adults. But I think, I don't know that it's like Twilight or whatever it is, but there's a lot of literature and a lot of books for kids that are actually designed to appeal on multiple levels as well. And plus, I just got like, I'm a big nerd for kids' books when they're well written.
Yeah.
Because the other thing is, like, kids' books are hard to write, they're hard to write well, which is why most of them are crap. It's just, most of them are just doggerel. And so you kind of latch onto the ones that you're big fans of. And plus, like, let's just be honest, is that Dan's got a kid, and so you know he's just like burbling over with enthusiasm to talk about his kid. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just saying that to have a child is to show everyone on earth pictures of your child and to drag the kid with you everywhere, regardless of whether the kid wants to be there or not, and then to shove the kid at other people. Not that he does this, but I'm saying in general. He's actually really good about it. He's pretty reserved. But, you know, people with babies that are, look, I have a baby. And they just and they want to sort of foist the kid on you.
Just to backstep briefly, Brian Fantana.
And
that's what Aaron Mesh looks like right now.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding. That the mustache, the sideburns, that length hair.
Wow.
That is what Aaron Mesh looks like right now.
Awesome. Well, I only wish he was coming in today.
I know.
Well, maybe next time. Brian Fantana, he's the Sex Panther guy.
Yeah.
You know, for the first, I don't know, 5,000 or 6,000 times I saw Anchorman, I didn't realize that was Paul Rudd. And I love Paul Rudd. I'm a big fan of that guy. But he just vanished so completely. He became Brian Fantana. And I didn't even really register that it was him.
And I didn't even make the connection that I saw Aaron Mesh looking like Brian Fantana last night at the new Adam McKay film with Will Ferrell. So I wonder if it was homage.
Maybe it was a theme night, Don.
Yeah.
Well, in any event, you know what I watched again just a couple nights ago was Role Models, which is just the best movie.
Yeah,
I mean Role Models, and it's not just because of the Kiss thing, because that's like a lot of people recommended it to me because of Kissanthia or whatever it is, where the country. It's just a really legitimately fantastically hilarious film that also it does that really neat trick that we were talking about with Futurama the other day, where it earns its sentiment in a way that does not feel forced or cloying. So. Anyway, we're all over the place today, but there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. Anyway, so we'll talk about kids' books with Dan Hanico, and also books for the older set when he comes in. That's going to be 2:00. What else? Job Watch on the way today. Penis Watch, Clown Watch on the way, and we will do today's top five. The top five songs from October 2nd, 1973, which is solely and completely and totally to make up for the fact that yesterday's top five was just repellent. It was just awful. It was awful in every way. I mean, I think the best thing on yesterday's top five list was Glory Days by Bruce Springsteen, but we got done with that one early, and then it was just dreck. It was just foulness and filth of a musical variety. So today we're going to have top five songs from the first week of October 1973, just to apologize to everyone. Also, to forestall, I say, even though I know that it won't actually do this, to forestall any emails about this, we did reformat part of rickemerson.com. If you go to rickemerson.com today, specifically if you go to the archives page, or if you just go to the page, you know, it's sort of the site that's set aside for this show. In other words, not the Legion of News section or the, you know, whatever. We've consolidated everything down into one page. The Listen Live, the Archives Access, and the blog are now all on one page. So who did that? Me. Who put this thing together? Me. I did.
Wow.
Just, you don't even know. Worked my fingers to the bone creating forms and tables and cells last night, Don.
I'm impressed.
Are you really impressed?
I am, and I'm grateful that it was you and not me.
Yeah. So, anyway, so it's not your browser. You haven't gone mental. Everything still works properly. At least it should. So that's all on one page now when you go to rickemerson.com and so forth. So we'll get to all of that. We got the Job Watch, Penis Watch, Clown Watch, Top 5 books, Willamette Week, and so forth. Ooh, is there something else? Wait a minute. No, because we got to the Michael Lowen song yesterday.
Yes.
Awesome. We rule. All right, Dawn Taylor, how are you today?
I'm good. I'm eating one of these chocolate chip cookies that you brought in yesterday.
And they're not very good.
I know this is a big difference between you and I. I bought a bunch of bagels at Kettleman's, and I got some jalapeno cream cheese.
I know what you're going to say, by
the way.
And
I said, hey, Rick Emerson, look, bagels and cream cheese in case you want some. And you were like, hey, awesome, that's great. And your response is, oh, there are these cookies I brought in because I hate them.
They're not any good, Dawn. They're in the kitchen for you, though.
Yeah. That it would not occur to you to bring cookies to share with others unless they were ones that you yourself have no interest in eating.
No, of course not. No, if that was the case, they stay at home where no one else can touch them. What are you, high? This is something really good. Let me give it away. I don't think so. By the way, if you'd like to give a gift subscription to this program, it is only 32 cents a day. If you'd like to do that, you can do that right here at rickemerson.com. So Lara, you know, God bless her. She is you know what she's really good about? She is really good she's much more of a healthy eater than I am. I mean, for the love of Christ, she jazzercises 6 days a week.
She does yoga too, doesn't she?
She's just nuts. Yeah. I mean, in the best way possible. You know what she did?
Met her that one day. We were going to buy chocolate for the chocolate tasting at some foodie thing we did, and she showed up and she looked just like, well, for one thing, she's about like a foot and a half taller than I am. You know, and I'm sort of this round, short, spherical person. And she shows up and she apologizes for her appearance because she had just come from yoga.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, you're a mess.
Welcome to my world, where I'm just shoving tater tots into my face day and night. And she's in the kitchen, mincing beets by hand that she grew in the garden out front. You know, that she fertilized with compost that was made of other things that she grew, like, you know, the month before. I'm not complaining about that. It just makes me feel like a big load. I mean, I just feel like a big greasy stain on the house. But you know, she does eat much healthier than I do, but she's really good about when she does kind of fall off the wagon. It isn't all that often because like today, goddamn, you know, she works with a big ass hill. You know, she bicycled to work and she had to be there at 7 a.m. So she's like, be sure to set my alarm for 5 so I can bicycle all the way up, you know, to Mount Doom. I'm like, well, all right, I'm going to be driving, by the way, and I work 30 seconds from home. when she does sort of buy something that is just flat out bad for her, she always calls home and she says, hey, I'm buying something bad for me. What do you want? And I said, and the answer is always the same, cookies. Bring me cookies. And she's not much of a cookie person. She'll eat them if they're around. But so she just sort of, she'll punt. And I don't mind saying this because I like a lot of their food. I like a lot of stuff at Trader Joe's. These cookies, not that. She brought this bag of cookies home, and it's this horror. It's just a note from me. This is a confidential from cookie connoisseur to cookie maker. Quit trying to make cookies taste and feel and seem like they just came out of the oven. I got them in a bag from Trader Joe's. They were made 6 months ago. The expiration date is next year. They were not just made. So quit. And the way that they try to make them soft is just by filling full of lard, except that it's not even lard because they're vegan, which in her defense, she did not know. Hmm. She denied it, actually. She just goes, they're not vegan. And it's in tiny, tiny little ass vegan lettering because they're crafty.
And I hear vegan and then all I think is, oh, well, then there's no butter.
No,
well, that's no good.
And they're not good. That's the thing. They're terrible.
They're not terrible. That's the thing is that they're just not terrible enough that I'm still sitting here eating it. But every time I take a bite, there's this part of my brain that's just going, it's not really not a good cookie.
See, and to me, they're just sort of, they're thin and bitter tasting, which I know seem like personality traits. But you know what I mean when a cookie is thin tasting, and maybe it is the lack of butter, there's no fullness to it. There's no richness. They're not rich. That's the deal. And there's a sharpness that vegan sweets have. I just try to avoid that stuff. Hey, you know how many vegans it takes to change a light bulb?
How many?
None, because vegans never change anything. I said, I got like 3 cookies in, you know, over the course of like the evening. And I finally just said, baby, you know, I'm really grateful that you did this, but these aren't any good. So I'm gonna take these to work. And she just went, okay, you know, fine, I'll get it. Because you know what they do have at Trader Joe's, which is why I feel okay about knocking these cookies. They have those cookies where it's like in a plastic tub and they're smallish. They are midway between a Famous Amos and Cookie Crisp cereal, and they are awesome. And they are so good, I've actually forbidden her to bring them home. They are so amazingly good, we cannot have them in the house, because I will eat them all. So.
What's really terrifying of the Trader Joe's cookies are the little crispy cats cookies. They look like little cats.
I've never seen those.
They're shaped like little cats, but they're fat-free. So the thing is, you're never actually satisfied. You don't get that satiety that you get, which is one of the functions of fat in food. Is it gives you flavor, it gives you moistness, and it satisfies, you know, on a biological level. So you eat something that's fat-free, and that part of your brain that gets satisfied with what you're eating never, ever kicks in.
So you just keep eating
eating these cookies, and there's this part of you, you're crunch, 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 and they taste good, but there's this part of your brain that just keeps going, when am I done? When will I be done? And the answer is never.
Never.
Because there's no fat in them. You just eat them until they're either gone or you hate yourself.
Have you ever read the novel Good Omens by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett?
I am a huge fan of that novel.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so there's that food that you eat where basically it's just like styrofoam, where it makes you really fat but doesn't give you any nutrients. And so you just, these people dying of malnutrition who weigh 500 pounds. That's kind of what some of those snacks. I have a friend of mine who shall remain nameless. I will not identify this person because I don't wish to embarrass anyone. I mean, I do, but I won't. We would occasionally be at the store together, and he would see something. Oh, let me just make something up that has no basis in reality. He would see something like a 2-pound bag of candy corn, you know, like the little triangular Halloween. I got no problem with candy corn, but he would say, "I'm gonna get that." And then later on, as you know, as there's like a Mystery Science Theater marathon or something happening, I would just hear this, and I look over, and it's like the 2-pound bag of candy corn is nearly gone. And I would say, "Phil, what are you doing?" And he'd say, "Oh, it's fat-free." And just continue with sort of the wet slurping sound. I expected him to lick the inside of the bag. Fat-free food makes people act very bizarrely.
Yeah.
It just, all right. All right, hell. We're so behind. We haven't even talked about. And I'm not going to pretend that I haven't heard this story before, because we talked about it a bit during Legion of News. I do have to ask though, because so I came into the studio today at dawn. It's one of those things where I sit down and I'm typing away and I'm trying to get the show ready and I'm preparing and creating news and and pithy observations about popular culture so that I might share them with people. And we're typing away, and it's like you were in electronic terms, a capacitor. It's like you were sitting there just building up and storing energy, and then you were just sort of pent up, and then you went, "You know what I hate?" And then just like out of the blue, you just unleashed this torrent of frustration at me about some jazz that happened to you at the convenience store this morning. And I don't really know. I only know the broad strokes, so now I realize that I have to tell you this so you don't go mental about it. So please now to tell me, what were you going to the convenience store to get, if I can ask?
I was
unless it was a lady product.
No, it was just a beverage, just a morning caffeinated beverage.
All right.
And I wasn't running late because I get here like, you know, 2 hours before you do every morning. But it was still one of those things of like, I don't want to spend time in 7-Eleven. It's not my favorite place. So you go to the convenience store and the expectation is I will get out of my car, walk directly to the thing I need, take it to the counter, pay for it, leave. I might have to wait for the person in front of me to buy their one item.
But you'll be in and out quickly.
Yeah. And I get there and I go to get the thing and there's like 10 people standing there. just waiting. And now, of course, I have to decide, am I going to attempt to stay or am I not going to stay? Well, I'm already here. So I get behind a couple of people. And it's like somebody had wanted to buy a lottery ticket, but the Powerball machine went down. And so one of the clerks is dealing with the Powerball machine. At the other register, a guy is buying like four, money orders.
With pennies.
You know, and this is going on at the two different registers. And so now I'm standing there and I'm trying to figure out, do I leave or do I stay? I've already invested like 5 minutes of my life into this.
Right.
And so then the next guy gets up and to the Powerball machine register, and he has got some elaborate thing going on where he's trying to buy a 12 pack of Coke with pennies or something.
Right.
You know, so that he's got that going on. Then at the next register over, a woman goes up, a Hispanic woman with three children, and I swear to God, she's doing all of her grocery shopping at 7-Eleven. She's got milk and orange juice and eggs and boxes of cereal and motor oil. And so now it's like, now I'm getting really angry because now I can't leave. Because now I've just, obviated any leaving that
right.
I could do. Because
right.
What am I going to do? Leave, drive 10 minutes to the Plaid Pantry, So then I stay there and I just...
And did you do this thing too? Because I... And somebody's got... What area code is 423?
I don't know.
Somebody's calling. Maybe Aaron Mesh, but it seems unlikely. All right, if you can...
It could be a cell phone.
Well, there's somebody I put on hold there. And they've hung up. All right, goodbye now. They'll call back. It's my mom used to say before we had an answering machine. But do you do this, too, when you are headed to work or anywhere? Do you know how many Plaid Pantries are between your home and the place, and you're trying to figure out which one you should stop at, and you go, well, there's two more. Well, there's one more. I got to stop at this one then. And then you go in, and that's where you're just like behind like 15 guys. Just sucks.
And so, and so finally, I did that whole thing where, like, I get these two, teenage boys that I'm behind. They, of course, want to buy, like 14 scratcher lottery tickets.
Right.
And they have to pick them all out individually based on, how much pocket change they have.
Or did you ever do this? And then we'll get to the phones here in just a second. There's someone waiting on hold, so we'll get there in a second. Did you ever do this, though, where you're standing behind somebody who's getting the scratch-off tickets, and then they're really interested in the different varieties of scratcher, the different games? Let's see.
Yeah.
What's Party Pals? Oh, look at that one. Okay, and what is that one called? Break the Ice? What's break? I'll take one break the ice and one. And you're just sitting behind me going, will you go? Will you just? I am always behind the guy who's getting the money order made or the person who pays. I was behind some nutcase woman a while back. She was sort of I hate to say this. She was like a Ketzel Levine type. She was one of those she was like 60 years old, still with the tie dye. She didn't drive there. She has like a little wheeled basket cart thing that she's on her way home from the grocery store, and she stopped by the Plaid Pantry with all of her wheeled things that on the side have like Jerry Garcia stickers, and the other side is all Obama Yes We Can stuff from 08. And then she's paying all of her monthly bills with money orders. And so she has to get like 9 of them made from the guy. And we're all stacking up behind her. And you do the thing of making eye contact with the other customers. And it's clear that you're all thinking, like Murder on the Orient Express style. Okay, I'll hold her down. You shoot her. I will stab her. We'll all dispose of the body together and no one is the wiser. And you're right. It's like then it becomes like an inconvenience store.
And it is. And it's like now. And it's the longest period of time in life. It's worse than the DMV. It's worse than anything. It's too long at the convenience store. Time stretches out to like a year. And then finally, I get up to the register, and the woman, of course, looks at me and says, "Oh, I'm sorry for the wait." And what do? I go, "Oh, it's okay.
It
happens.
It's not a problem."
What I want to do is just go, "I hate you all."
Awesome.
But I'm like, nah, it's fine.
But you don't do that, Don, because you're a good person.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see who's on the telephone. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. This may, in fact, be Aaron Mesh. It may be somebody altogether different. Hi, who might
this
be?
It is Aaron Mesh.
Oh, for the love of God, it's so loud. All right, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. All right. Hello, Aaron Mesh. How are you on this Wednesday, sir?
I'm doing well. I'm walking between different interviews in Old Town right now.
Are you in it? When you say walking between different interviews, are you interviewing like interviewing, are you interviewing applicants for some sort of exciting job at Willamette Week, or are you interviewing people whose stories will be profiled in your fine paper?
The second one. I'm working on a variety of stories on the tech sector, and so I'm going to different startups today and chatting with tech sector folks.
Before we go any further here, because I can't not mention this. If I were to not mention this, it would just be disingenuous. So, what was the film last night, Don?
The Other Guys.
Don Taylor went to see The Other Guys last night, and she said that you've made made, I guess, a pleasing but startlingly different facial hair choice.
Yeah, I've got a big mustache right now.
And so is that it? Now, did you wait a minute? Now you didn't have like facial hair at all when you were here last time, did you?
Oh yeah, I've had a beard for years and years.
Did he have a beard the last time he was here?
Yes, he did.
Why don't I remember that at all? I guess maybe it's just because you sound so well scrubbed and clean shaven. You sound like such a respectable young man that I just I can't picture you in my mind's eye having a beard. So she said you've got sort of a like a Hetfield meets My Name Is Earl kind of a thing going on.
I consider it to be a tribute to the late Dennis Hopper, but, you know.
Well done.
Call it what you like.
Excellent. All right, fair enough. It's exactly what you should tell people. And then you should say a thing, you know, you should just end your conversation by saying, hey, Peter Man, the breast chick is on. And just, you know, sort of punctuate your conversations with that.
I could just yell Pabst Blue Ribbon really angrily a lot.
Exactly. So when you say startups in the tech sector, this is one of those, we were just talking last hour actually about how everything sort of feels like it's 1995 all over again with the you know, in the political arena. But I would not think that with the, what with the economy and all, I would not think that there'd be a lot of tech startups happening right now except for our fine organization.
Well, I can't give it away. Otherwise, you know, I give away the story I'm working on. But there's some interesting stuff happening in Portland's tech sector.
Is it?
I don't know if you had a chance to stop by OzCon at all last week, but we did host the National Open Source Convention, which is a way of saying techies who will do things for free.
Is the Open Source Convention? Is that like the like a bunch of those like Linux guys who like who sit around and show you something that they soldered together in their basement while Doctor Who was playing in the background?
You know, that's pretty accurate. Although that's about 9 years old at this point. Open source geeks are pretty much just as connected to corporate world as anybody else. In fact, there were big tables at OzCon from companies like IBM and Microsoft who are looking for the next big thing. So they've, you know, depending on how you look at it, either cashed in, sold out, or learned a little something in the process.
The idea that Microsoft would be at an open source convention is sort of hilarious, actually. That's just sort of, it's perversely
it's like,
amusing.
It's like Darth Vader setting up a tent at the Rebel convention.
Exactly. I find your lack of DRM disturbing. All right, so this is...
But would you mind working for me for, you know...
And the answer, by the way, is yes. Let me just say this about that I have known more than a few. But we have actually some listeners who work at Microsoft, and I'm a big fan of that company. I really am. As bloated and frustrating as their products sometimes are, but I will tell you this: of the people I know who had their own software company or a startup firm who then got absorbed by Microsoft or who then got a job offer from Microsoft, everybody I know that they would just be sitting at home, just ranting and screaming and bitching and moaning about how Microsoft was, you know, they were a monopoly and they were the death of innovation. I can count on zero fingers the number of my friends who turned down a job offer from that company when it came.
Well, I mean, I think you see that in every cultural practice. I mean, name me the guy who was given a chance to sell out who didn't.
No. I just wait until the appropriate number of zeros is there. That's the thing. It's just it's all about setting the appropriate price and then demanding a parking space that's somewhere near the front, so you have to walk from from building Y. So this will be coming out. Soon. What is in the current issue of Willamette Week, my friend?
Well, the current issue of Willamette Week is highlighted by a fascinating interview with Brian Boitano.
Really?
Brian Boitano is going to be in Portland this weekend at the Bite of Oregon Festival, pimping his television show, his cooking show. Did you know that Brian Boitano had a cooking show?
I didn't really know that Brian Boitano. I thought that he had people for that, to just ferry him plates full of grapes.
I'm sorry, one more time.
I this is like when we talked to Tom Lenk. I feel like you're about to drop dead of a coronary. You're doing this sort of heavy breathing thing into the phone. I feel like you're going to be face down in the gutter at some point during this conversation. My speculation was that Brian Boitano was just so massively wealthy that he had, sort of cherub-like servants to sort of ferry him, saucers full of the finest grapes and cheeses.
That's probably. Actually, I have no idea how much money Brian Bresciano makes, but he seems fascinated by cooking, and so he now has a cooking show called What Would Brian Boitano Cook?
Okay, that's awesome. What channel is that on? Because that's a thing I will watch for the title alone.
Let me check.
Don
here
Taylor,
in the paper,
you know?
So.
All right, we'll rustle.
Kelly Clark did the interview. Let me pull out this paper here and see what channel Brian Boitano's show is on.
That's fantastic.
It is on, let's see. It's actually What Would Brian Boitano Make? Sorry, it's on the Food Network.
All right, excellent. I'm going to remotely program my TiVo, like as soon as this call is done. I'm going to go to TiVo.com and set my TiVo to record that. That is fantastic. Excellent.
No, I think you should. And he's going to be in Portland at the Tom McCall Waterfront Park on Saturday and Sunday.
Excellent. All right. What Would Brian Boitano
cooking.
Make a food channel? He's going to be cooking, really? They're going to have him. Is it going to be sort of an in-person cooking demonstration by Brian Boitano?
I believe that is correct, yes.
Goddamn, we live in the weirdest world. I mean, this is just this planet is just you know what this whole planet is? This planet has become like that Simpsons scene where Homer's talking about, you know, the idea that, you know, any two things put together will somehow, you know, appeal to, you know, to people, to things that have never been put together before. And he opens the cupboard and it's just filled with a product called nuts and gum in a box. all right. I'll let you get
and
to your...
And now it's Brian Boitano and bacon apple tarts.
Which I am all over. I'll let you get to your interview and so forth. I look forward to seeing your exciting facial hair in person, my friend.
Well, I'm going to try to stop it in the next few weeks, Rick, and my apologies for the heavy breathing. It's just that, you know, you turn me on, so.
Well, it's okay. It's not so, so much me as it is the pants. All right, there you go. That's Aaron Mesh, ladies and gentlemen, from Willamette Week. All right, there you go. And done. All right. What Would Brian Boitano Make, Don Taylor? That's the name of the show. How are you doing over there?
I'm doing fine. I'm okay.
You got that look on your face like there's something, some sort of, some interesting thing being texted to you.
Oh, no, I'm just trying to keep abreast of the Proposition 8.
Oh, that's right. So that's coming in today. Well, let's find out more about that, Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
I should have put together like a gay watch or something.
Yeah.
Well, next
Work
time.
Work on that,
yeah.
Won't you?
There'll be future opportunities.
This afternoon, U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker ruled in the case brought before him by lawyers Ted Olson and David Boies, which argued that the Proposition 8 ballot initiative denying marriage rights to same-sex couples in California was unconstitutional. In a decision just handed down to lawyers for both sides,
Is this breaking news?
Yeah, this is pretty much breaking news.
Damn me. Hold on a second. Let me find my break.
We have breaking news music?
I haven't had a chance to use it yet because there's really been no breaking news as such. We haven't really, you know, it's not a thing. It's not a thing that we've really had. It's not a thing we've really had call for. This is absolutely worth waiting on. Let's see. What would Brian Boitano make? All right. Let me see if this is the right thing. I've got several news sounders. I believe this is the breaking news sounder. Let me just check. Hold on. All right. And wait a minute. Wait.
That news is breaking.
It's not as breaking as it is. It's just broken.
It's shattering.
Let me try this one. Oh, for the love of God. Okay, now this is going to be...
Can you sing it?
You know what I can sing? Is I can sing a song called Shut Up while I try to find this. This is going to be... You mark my words. This is going to be one of those days where the computer tries to F me at every opportunity. All right, let me try one more here. I'll give you one more attempt at the breaking news sounder because I feel like if I don't at least give it the... That's not really what I was looking for. How about... No,
that's
the one
it.
We use. That's the one we use now. Okay, if it's not this one, I'm giving up. Hey.
There we go.
All right, this is breaking news from the Emerson News Network. Don Taylor.
U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker has ruled in the case brought before him, arguing that Proposition 8's ballot initiative denying marriage rights to same-sex couples in California was unconstitutional. In a decision just handed down to lawyers for both sides, Walker ruled that Proposition 8 is, quote, unconstitutional under both the Due Process and Equal Protection clauses.
Bam!
The court therefore, quote, orders entry of judgment permanently enjoining its enforcement. There will be more updates and details on the 136-page decision, but these two sentences from the conclusion are critical. Proposition 8 fails to advance any rational basis in singling out gay men and lesbians for denial of marriage license. Indeed, the evidence shows Proposition 8 does nothing more than enshrine in the California Constitution the notion that opposite-sex couples are superior to same-sex couples. And that, my friends, is the sound of history being made.
There you go. In your face. Yeah. That's awesome. Fantastic. See, was that not worth waiting for the breaking news sound?
That was.
But let's just one more time just to... There we go. Awesome. So, all right. So, well, I never know how any of this stuff works. So then what is... So Proposition 8 has been... they've enjoined it statewide. So this is a state court?
Yes.
It's a state court.
Yeah.
So then it seems to me that then the... well, you know, fortunately, tomorrow we're going to be joined by Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. She was talking about... she wrote a piece a while back about the Oregon version of this whole fight. And so we'll be able to sort of get a handle on where this goes. Because it seems like then it's going for the inevitable Supreme Court showdown, which will be awesome, by the way. That's a thing they ought to sell tickets to.
Yeah, and this was a federal judge. This was federal court. Yeah. So... basically, this is a huge precedent as far as any of these anti-gay marriage bills trying to go through in other states.
So court tells anti-gay activist to suck it.
Pretty much,
that's the headline. Awesome. That's, you know, I knew it was going
to
be. And
essentially, to put it in other words, a federal judge has said that gays and lesbians have a constitutional right to get married.
Why, that's communism, Don, and other things as well. Awesome. There you go. It's, you know, I have to say, sometimes you wake up and your feet hit the floor and you think to yourself, my God, another day of this toil and drudgery and strife. You know, you can just smell it's just a bad day coming down the pike. And then there are days you wake up and you say to yourself, today is going to be a fine day. Mm-hmm. And I had that sense about this morning when I woke up and I was walking around the house and just idly scratching myself. And I thought, this is going to be a fine day to be alive. It's going to be a good show. My whole life is going to be on an upswing today. And sure enough, everything today has gone. Even the things that were threatening to go poorly, like I kicked out the cord for this thing at the beginning of the show. Found the cord, plugged it in, thing working properly. Didn't think Aaron Mesh's phone call was going to work out. Sounds like you couldn't hear us at the beginning. Worked properly. Proposition 8, permanently enjoined from being enforced. Bam. That's what I'm saying. Even the mutual news sounding thing, which I couldn't find there for a second, found it, came together. It all conflated in the most glorious way possible.
And your hair looks terrific.
Does it really?
It does.
Thank you.
It looks fine.
That's nice of you to say. Let's start the news segment again. Here's Don Taylor, ladies and gentlemen, at the news desk. Now it's screwing me. This is what I get for just saying that everything was going properly. Now everything is stopping on me. I may have to restart the news sound here. But this is Don Taylor at the news desk.
A Hillsborough woman broke her ankle Thursday night after falling from the stage at the Washington County Fair during a performance by Gallagher. The comedian had nearly finished his act when he asked for volunteers to join him on stage in order to get birthday cakes smashed in their faces. The DeMar Bachelor Amphitheater stage, which was covered in black plastic, was slick with the remnants of fruit, honey, mashed potatoes, sauerkraut, and other items that Gallagher had smashed earlier in his act. As a sizable group of volunteers began to make its way to the stage, Gallagher made frequent requests for people to not walk up a steep ramp out front, which was covered in plastic and slick with food remnants, but to use an uncovered wing of the stage that was not slick. He was instructing them where to go. He was instructing them to go where you were supposed to go, said Ruth Ann Proper of Sold Out Shows.
I would imagine.
Who I guess was the event coordinator. One lady didn't listen to Gallagher and went up the ramp, and it broke under her weight. The woman later identified... Am I buzzing?
Hold on, let me see.
Is it just me?
Hold on.
Hold on
a second. Let me just... little bit.
Okay.
Is that they? Are you gripping the microphone in some way?
No, I'm not touching the microphone. I just was hearing... I keep hearing this odd little... little buzziness.
There's a little bit of a small hum in the background.
The woman was identified as Dana Weatherly, 32, of Hillsborough. She broke her ankle in two places. Seconds before the accident, Gallagher had told one woman that she was going to, quote, fall on your ass if she didn't go around. After Weatherly had fallen, Gallagher called to her saying, what did I say?
There's nothing like being heckled by a comedian after, in fact, you have fallen and injured yourself.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Gallagher. You nailed it when you said that he was just kind of a dick.
Yeah.
You know, and
he's a cranky, crotchety, angry, bitter dick of a man. He's a horrible, horrible man.
And I mean, you know, and on the one hand, you can sort of see, on the one hand, you said to yourself, well, look, you make a living smashing watermelon. I mean, really, like, what is it? What do you have to complain about? On the other hand, I guess you can understand, sort of where he's coming from, in the sense that it's, and I can't believe I'm coming to the defense of Gallagher, because he just seems like such a prick, you know, and he's got that whole business where he tried to franchise himself, and his brother was out there as Gallagher too.
Well, he's also racist and sexist and homophobic. I mean, the things he actually says in during the course of his act.
Well, now just hold. Has a fairy gotten his wings somewhere?
Apparently, yes. Hewlett-Packard decided that my laptop should get its wings.
All right.
Right now.
Here's the reason I ask that is because it's, I really don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen. The last time I saw Gallagher perform was 1993, I think, in Spokane, where he had three sold out nights at the quote opera house end quote, which is like Spokane in a nutshell, the reason I ask that is because that's, you know, you call somebody, especially a comedian, you know, you say they're racist or sexist. It's like comedians have to be judged, I think, on a separate level, just because stuff that, like, you can't say at the office, you can say on stage as a comic.
I would encourage you or anyone who disbelieves me to just basically do a Google search of his recent performances.
There's no need to be defensive.
I'm not being defensive. I'm just explaining.
I did not say I disbelieved you. I asked if that was true. I was asking for clarification
on
this.
No, it's true.
All right. So in any event, you do understand, though, why the guy gets sort of grumpy in some ways, because show business is a hard place to maintain a career, and especially comedy, which is just so, you know, it's such a mercurial industry where it's, you know, here today and then gone later today. And that's a guy who's had, you know, a career that's gone for, like, I don't know, 30 years, where other people just get left by the wayside, and he continues to tour and sell out, you know, kind of everywhere he goes. I mean, you know, depending on the market, I guess. And he has an ongoing series of specials. He has huge name recognition. Everybody knows who he is, not unlike Carrot Top. And yet everybody just sort of hates him, and he's just constantly reviled and ridiculed. And so I think that's the thing that probably bugs him, is that if he was not successful in the abstract, like in terms of the absolute finite, in terms of absolute dollars and tickets sold, if he wasn't successful, I think that the other stuff wouldn't bother him that much. But I think the fact that he does sell so many tickets and make so much money, and he has so many fans, and yet everybody just constantly rails on him. Because that's the thing with guys like that, is that regardless of what they say, they always want critical respect. Artists always claim that they don't. They always go, well, look, I don't care if the critics like me, so long as the people like me, which is always a lie. It's a lie when musicians say it, and it's a lie when comics say it. It's a lie when actors say it.
Yeah, interviews with him, he pretty much comes out and just says that a lot of his intense deep anger, and he has a lot of anger, is about the fact that he's just not recognized as being the genius that he is for blazing the comedic trail with smashing the watermelons with the giant hammers.
It sounds like I'm getting all angry about the Gallagher thing. I'm really not. It's just that I'm so conflicted about that guy, which sounds like a retarded thing to be conflicted. It's like I'm conflicted about, like, you know, about, like, peanut butter chips or something. But is your obvious disdain for Gallagher because of the way he seems as a person? In other words, not the way he is on stage, not his act or his smashing stuff. The way that he comes off as a guy in interviews, or is it because you don't like his act and so therefore you dislike him?
I don't really care about his act one way or the other, honestly. It's like, you know, Carrot Top takes a lot of crap too, and I don't really care for prop comedy, but honestly, I don't care what he does. The difference being that I don't get the sense that Carrot Top takes himself that seriously. I also get to, Carrot Top seems also like someone I wouldn't really want to spend a whole lot of time with.
Seriously.
But he also seems like someone who knows how insanely lucky he is to be a millionaire.
Right.
From, like, playing with puppets and doing gags about, like, squeaky toys and crap, you know? Whereas Gallagher is not only angry, but also just rails about, like, you know, super conservative right-wing stuff on stage. There was an article, somebody else points out that, good, there was a really good article in The Stranger a few months ago about his onstage act with just racist, homophobic comments during the course of his act. And that's in addition to actual interviews with him where he is just, he is so angry and so full of hate towards other comedians, towards show business in general. He is so bitter. And it's just really hard when you look at that, and then you look at what his actual act consists of.
So that's my question. I'm just trying to get to the root of this.
I mean, I would find him reprehensible no matter what his act was. It's just extra ludicrous
because he has no talent, yeah. In your opinion. Okay, so I see. I can get that because I'm willing to bet that if you went through my record collection and your record collection, about 75% of the artists we listen to and love are just horrible people.
Oh, yeah.
Just on some level. But it's that thing of like...
Yeah, but somebody Bob Hope or Frank Sinatra kind of earned it.
Well, and the thing is, like, I'm willing to cut you personal slack if you make up for it artistically.
Yeah.
Also,
they kept it off stage. That's another thing, too, is they kept it out of their performances. I will cut people enormous amount of slack for being dickheads if that's just who they are in their personal life. Because if what they are selling to me as a performance is still something I find of artistic value, you know, I can reconcile the fact that, okay, in what I've heard is that in your real life, you're a jerk. But if they bring that onto stage, if people are paying money to actually not only see Gallagher break things with, you know, with mallets, but also to comment on women's breasts, to make horrible jokes about gay people, to make just deeply offensive racist jokes on top of everything else. It's like, no, I'm sorry. No, you lose.
See, it's one of those things where you've obviously come to the end of this algorithm and you've arrived at a sum. I have so many, and it's not even about Gallagher as such. It's just that, like, Gallagher is, I swear to God, I never thought I would be talking this much about Gallagher and using phrases like, Don, Gallagher is a microcosm. But I think that guy is a microcosm of all the different facets of show business, and the fact that while I actively root against lots of people because they're horrid, and I just, Larry the Cable Guy is a good example, that Dan Whitney guy, where I just pray for horrible things to happen to him. It's just every day that I wake up and the headline does not say that Larry the Cable Guy has gotten like a huge tumor on one of his eyes. It's just another bad day for me. But then by the same token, you say to yourself, well, it's a tough racket, and if you can convince a bunch of fools to give you money to just go and do some hack work on stage, you know, the same thing you were doing in 1980, then I guess kind of more power to you. The interview that you're doing that thing where you're breathing angrily into the microphone.
Sorry.
You're just all just Gallagher. I read an interview with Gallagher in The Onion about 2 years ago, and that was the first time I really got the full, distilled, unvarnished sense of just what an ass he is and just like how embittered. And that's the word I would use. I wouldn't even say he's angry. He's just like a bitter guy. Because here's my thing with comedians and with music and with acting and writing and whatever, is that I will forgive almost any kind of content. I think maybe that's one of the differences here too in this conversation. That I will forgive almost anything in terms of how offensive it is, or if it is sexist, or misogynistic, or racist, or intolerant. I will forgive almost any of that if it's done in a way that is at least entertaining or thought out or comedic. I mean, you know, Sam Kinison had all kinds of things that would not fly today. And there's all kinds of comics, especially from, since time immemorial, that have said things that you wouldn't say in polite company because it would get you punched in the face and disinvited to family reunions. But it's like if you put a certain amount of thought and flair into it, I can kind of get with that. Whereas, as you said, it's a guy just getting up there and just being like a jackass about
it. Well, as a quick example, before we move on to other things, this is from the piece that was written in The Stranger, and it was about a show he did in Bremerton. And just the writer just jotted down a number of things from his act, just throwaway jokes in between smashing fruit about Mexicans. Look around. See any Mexicans? Nope. They'll be here later for cleanup. On the French, they ruin our language with their faggy words. Guantanamo Bay, we weren't even allowed to torture all the way. We had to half torture. That's nothing compared to what Saddam and his two sons, Ufe and Gufe, did. On Obama, if Obama was really black, he'd act like a black guy and get a white wife. on women's lib. Women, these women told you they want to be equal. They don't. And I like this one especially on people who are transgender. People like Cher's daughter, figure that out. She wants a penis, but she has a big belly. If you can't see your dick, you don't get one.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at that.
But, you know,
that was involuntary.
This is, and that is just a small sample from a long paragraph of crap from that was going on during his act.
I suppose, but I suspect that you pick one of those lines and you stuck it in the mouth of the right comedian, I don't think people would be offended by it. I think people give him a disproportionate amount of crap because I'll tell you what, any of those things, I would imagine you could place in the act of another comic and it would not get that kind of response from you.
He also said offered a Bible verse, without God, we are nothing but dust. What is butt dust? Is that what you get if your homosexual isn't properly lubricated?
See, it was funny until the last part. See, that to me, that's offensive because it's just not funny.
Apparently, he makes a lot of jokes about gay men. A lot of jokes. Like, to the point where it becomes uncomfortable. Like, why do you keep talking about gay men, Gallagher?
You seem awfully obsessed with gay sex.
Like, one of his things. There's only one kind of homosexual guy, and that's the pretty ones. Why do homosexual men have to be so good-looking? Well, Gallagher.
I'm sorry, was that a joke? I'm not sure that actually counts
as
humor.
No, I think that's just Gallagher oversharing with the audience.
But see, again, it's like, I would forgive almost any of this if I thought it was just done in a funny way. Because, there's nothing, there is no material. And I can see your eyes narrowing as you're sifting for other nuggets over there.
No, I'm putting it away now this, because I just...
Because I don't think there's any subject in there that could not be talked about by a comic and probably has been talked about by a comic in a way that's not offensive.
Yeah.
To me, the biggest sin of an entertainer is just when they're not funny. You want to talk about a guy who has a predilection for the homosexual humor is Kevin Smith. But in no way have I ever found any of it offensive, and it's not because I'm not gay. Now I'm doing your thing. I'm not offended by Kevin Smith's gay humor because I know that he's not anti-gay. So I guess that's unfair. I'm being unfair in reverse though because I'm giving Kevin Smith a pass because I know that he is not bigoted, or at least I sense that he is not intolerant.
Sometimes it's just hard to quantify it. Sometimes it's from hearing a person or from reading a person's words in context that they are vile. They are not saying something for entertainment's sake. They're not saying something that's moderately politically incorrect. And maybe it's a little shocking. Maybe it's a little harsh, but it's still presented in a funny way. Sometimes you read or hear someone, a comic or whoever, say something, and you just go, wow, you are a douche.
Dude, you're a dick.
Yeah.
All right. God, what time is it? Oh, it's 10 after. We gotta get underway. All right. Well, hell. Well, let's do this. We'll come back. We got Mr. Dan Hanico from Powell's Books. He's going to be here in just a few. Later on, we'll have today's top five. Top five songs from October 2nd, 1973, ladies and gentlefolk. And something else. Oh, yeah. Job Watch, Penis Watch, Clown Watch on the way. Don't forget all of today's merriment and whimsicality brought to you by folks such as The Cleaning Solution and the person of Michael Beatty, 971-533-533. 3211, 971-533-3211. You stay there. The Rick Emerson Show continues next right here on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere. Back after this. One flesh, one bone, one true religion.
one voice, one hope, one real decision. Whoa, whoa, whoa. One bone, one true religion, one race, one hope, one real decision.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. Coming up later on, we have today's top five. Top five songs from October. And I had the date wrong. It's October 20th. Top five songs from October 20th, 1973. Chosen solely and simply as an antidote to yesterday's top five, which is just repellent in every way. If you want to email, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. There's this face that you get sometimes when you're typing in the text box, and it's a face I can only call like a Lucy Van Pelt kind of face. And it's where either you are really intent on making a point, or something is vexing or frustrating you. Either a thing, an object, a person, maybe the internet itself, and you're really trying to, like, you're trying to accomplish something and you're being thwarted, or it's going slower than you might have anticipated.
It could also be that I'm trying to type around a mic stand and not bump into the windscreen with my face.
And doing a fine job of it,
thank
I might
you.
Say. All right, it's 503-505-6964. Just a moment, we'll be joined by Dan Hanico from Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing. We'll talk about the books for the younger set, children's books that are crossing over now, and then it's just a big excuse for us to sit and talk about. I like Tucker's Pigeon Ride by George Sheldon, or you know whatever. Let's see. Join us tomorrow, by the way, when our guest will be Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Wednesday. Don Taylor, what headlines are you following for the good people of Portland?
Well, there's a hearing set to find out how Terry Horman's going to pay for her lawyer. Unemployment payments have been delayed in Oregon. And what was this other one? I don't know what the other one is. I'm confused.
What's going on over there?
I wasn't expecting you to go to me about the news thing, so I thought we were going straight to Dan. So
I'll fire a flare gun next time.
Thank you. You try waving a paper at me like I wave at you. And see
in it. Just a moment, Dawn will be all right. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. This is one of those places where I meant to have the cello music ready as sort of the ongoing book club music, and then I forget. And it always just ends up being the porn music, which is just so awkward. But it's, what are you going to do? To welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, a longtime friend of the program, Mr. Dan Hanico from Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing. Hello, sir. How are you on this Wednesday?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you.
So I'm going to – I actually lied just now before we got – I'm going to have you move a little bit closer to the microphone. We are – the saga of the missing microphone has been – I won't say it's been a source of fascination. It's been a source of interest to almost no one but me. But because I'm here and there's no one to make me stop, I just end up talking about it every day. So we're playing a little bit of musical microphones here. I am on Dawn's mic. Dawn is on the guest mic. You're on the mic that nobody wants. Sorry about that. And that's because it's lacking a windscreen. So if I have you move or if I adjust it at some point, don't you take that as a personal affront, Dan. How's life? How is your son is, don't take this the wrong way, your son is huge.
He's like in the 90 percentile about everything.
I mean, you got to go check out the, Ian, when you get a second. First of all, he's like 100 feet tall at this point, which, and I swear to God, I just saw him a few weeks ago and he was small. Kids are like self-extracting software programs, you know, where it just seems like it's like 5K and then suddenly it's this massive thing that runs in 9 languages on multiple operating systems.
Yeah, he's 1 year old. He just turned 1 year, and now he's ready for the world.
And then he's wearing a skull and crossbone shirt, which is way cooler than anything my parents ever. Let me ask you this. I don't mean to. Now, are you married, or is it just cohabitating? Or
living
just,
in sin.
Okay, I just
long term sin.
No, it didn't really matter. I couldn't remember the state there. I didn't want to refer to her incorrectly. But is there any sort of the like the back and forth dynamic about what you dress the kid in? Because I know that occasionally. One member of the family who wants to put him in something very traditional or at least sort of neutral. And then there's like my friend Dennis Pitzenberger is like this, where it's like he just wants to dress the kid in, and it's like a, you know, baby girl, and he wants to put in like nothing but like Gene Simmons clothing, which I guess is okay, you know, and it's okay because it's not my kid. But I know that causes some friction in the home. You have anything like that?
Well, if there's anything that I wear or the kid wears that's cool, it's her idea.
Okay, so that is because you're always a very well-dressed man.
She is. She's got a great fashion sense.
Now, is that a thing you knew right off? Or how do I put this? How long had you known her when she started making observations or suggestions or perhaps just started forcing you to wear different things?
You know, it wasn't long at all. I mean, as soon as I moved to Portland, we met in Eugene. So when we came up to Portland, I got a shirt.
And did she say, no, this – was she polite about it? Did she say, no, this would look really good on you?
Yeah, it was a present.
And see, that's – she didn't say like, oh, my God, I cannot believe that they let you out of the house wearing that.
No, it was a present because now I was meeting her friends.
And, well, and you don't want to have – my wife has this term she calls the embarrassing boyfriend syndrome. And embarrassing boyfriend syndrome is like a grown-up version of embarrassing parent syndrome, but it's way worse because it's like you chose the boyfriend. You didn't choose your parents. So if your boyfriend is just being an ass or he's just wearing something bad like I did for the majority of my life, that's just it bad in every way. I wish that my mom – you know, my mom is a – she's a simple woman. You know, and it's like she dresses – there's a lot of photos from me when I was a kid where it's like I'm outside and my mom is working in the yard and she's wearing a Rainier beer tank top with nothing underneath, clearly, and it's a hot summer day and it's all very awkward. And that was the sort of clothing my mom wore. So she was no one to give my dad advice, but I so desperately wish that someone had, because it's like he was just wearing – like he would just go to church. Like my dad was that guy where he got like the new suit, but it was like the new suit in 1968. And it was still the new suit in 1979, and he wore it to church every Sunday. And I swear to God, it looked like someone had gotten a couch from the dumpster behind a Salvation Army and had just stitched it into a clothing ensemble for him. So you are like way ahead of the curve, my friend. So let's talk about books. So you got Ian. I don't know how any of this stuff works with kids. When do kids learn to read?
You know, I'm still finding this out. I mean, he's to the point now where he looks at a book and it's more than just an object. He is now seeing the picture. So earlier on, it was a square object that opened up, and that was fine. Now he's noticing that there's something on the page, or actually like a board book. It's on the board, and he's kind of looking at, you know, kitty or dog or whatever. So I think that that's the earliest form of reading right there. He's recognizing patterns on page as opposed to just object.
Now, do you do the thing of not letting him, I mean, he's only like a year old now, but do you do the thing of keeping him away from the television or not having the television on when he's in the room?
You know, before we had him, we thought that's how it was going
to
be.
You made a lot of vows to yourself that were almost immediately broken.
Exactly. You know, and now you can see him over there and he's giving it the eye. But, you know, we don't like let it babysit him, but, you know, we're not going to stop watching TV.
See, that's going to be another thing. You go, well, we said we weren't going to let it babysit him. Where is he at home? He's watching a Degrassi marathon right now. The thing about the television is, especially with children, which I guess is maybe not, I guess it's not that surprising, is that it has this almost like talisman effect. And I mean, on an adult, too. I mean, I'll find myself like in a bar or something and, you know, and I watch a lot of TV, but I also make a point to turn it off and to read, you know, the book now and again, or just to actively get away from it. In other words, I don't mindlessly surf or graze. I destination watch and then I turn it off. But then you find yourself like in a bar or a restaurant and the TV's on, even if it's something you could not possibly care less about. And then you find yourself just sort of staring at it fixedly and you realize what a glorious thing it is for the lazy parent. Because you can stick your kid in front of that, and it's just like and it just occupies them endlessly. I mean, world without end. It'll just take care of them. So, what is the first book you're going to give your kid, Ian, when he's old enough? What is the first thing you're going to try to get him to read?
Oh, gosh. You know, I mean, it sounds cliche, but I loved Where the Wild Things Are when I was a kid. You know, that was, I mean, little boy in his pajamas goes out into the Dream Island, stirs up trouble, becomes king. That book was pretty cool for me when I was, I don't know, four, five.
When people come in and they're looking for a book for their kids or for their, like, they have, you know, kids of however old, do they just defer to your judgment or do they just go immediately for whatever they were reading growing up?
I think a lot of people go with what they are growing up with. I see that all the time. And, you know, after a while, a lot of people say, well, what are kids reading today? But first thing, you know, out of the bat is, hey, I loved this book when I was a kid. I know that my kid's going
to
love it.
Right.
And that's probably not going to be the case.
Don Taylor, what is the first book that you remember reading on your own? In other words, the first book that you were aware of reading without assistance all the way through?
I really don't know. I don't know. My parents started me trying to teach me to read as soon as it was possible to do so. And I do remember that this, as the story went, I don't actually remember this because I was too young, but as the story went, they had these flashcards that had a picture of something and then it had the word next to it, you know, bear, house, chair, tree. And I figured it out really, really quickly and I was really good at it. And then one day my dad got the bright idea to just cover up the picture and I had no idea what the word was. I was just going, house, tree.
Just punting.
Like, she's a genius. So, but I do know that I was reading before kindergarten. I was actually reading, you know, books. So I don't know.
Dan Hanica, first book you remember reading on your own?
A lot of dinosaur stuff. I couldn't give you the exact title, but I read Dinosaur.
That's one of those things where you can never go wrong. Lara's got some friends, and they have kids, and the girl is much harder to buy for. She's like maybe four or five. And it's just because because girls are just more complex and interesting, and guys have got like two moving parts. When you're kid, you got one moving part, and that's the dinosaur part, and that's it. Dinosaurs or perhaps piranha. And so you can never, ever, ever go wrong with that.
Yeah, I knew that. My mother signed up for this thing called the I Can Read It Myself Club when I was a kid, and they would send you a book like every week or every month or something, and it was like all the Dr. Seuss titles and things like Hop on Pop and stuff like that. So I did have a stack of those, as well as all the golden books. So I had an enormous amount of books when I was really, really young. So, and I do remember reading all the Hop on Pop and Green Eggs and Ham and that stuff when I was pretty darn small.
And then when you get to be like a, like what we would now call a young adult, that is when, at least for me, that's when you latch on to things that you will then begin to read over and over and over and over again. And there was this, Don and I've talked about this before, there was this study that said they said that the years between 20 and 25 are when you form the music taste that you identify with most strongly. In other words, the music that you will love the most or that you will consider yours or that will resonate the strongest with you is typically the music that you were exposed to or learned to love between the ages of 20 and 25. But I think with books, I think it's like 10 and 15. Because that's where and we've talked about the Harriet the Spy thing.
Yeah.
Where I just read Harriet the Spy like 1,000 times. And there was no... There was no sense that I was like, overreading it, or that I should be reading, you know, that I should be moving on. I mean, I read other stuff too, but I would latch on to that, or I've talked about The Cricket in Times Square a lot, which is a fantastic book.
Yeah, I read and reread the Dr. Doolittle books like over and over again as a kid, and my husband and I were just talking about this the other day, that it's been so long since we read them that we were thinking about going and getting them and going back to them, because we both remember loving the Dr. Doolittle series, but we remember almost nothing about it because it's been so long since we read them.
Was there a sequel? Danny, you might know this. Was there a sequel written to Harriet the Spy?
Yeah, The Long Secret.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you see, I'm glad I didn't know about that, because I think I might have...
It wasn't... I didn't like it as much. I was quite disappointed. That was one of my first experiences being disappointed with a...
When did that come out?
With a sequel. A couple of years later.
Ah, interesting, because usually that's one of those things, and it's like with books... Man, sequelizing books is such a dicey proposition, like way more so than sequelizing movies. Because if there's a bad movie sequel that comes out, you know, you just kind of go, well, what are you going to do? You know, because like you don't really expect it to be good. But with books, and you probably see this at Powell's, where things will be freighted with expectation. Sequelized, books will be like that. And I mean, I don't, but a lot of them are sort of written all at once. But, not counting a franchise or something. I mean, has there ever been a sequel to a notable book that was actually just as good?
Oh, I'm instantly thinking about the Godfather franchise on the movies, but...
See, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
With books, it's much more difficult, I think, and they're doomed to failure, it seems like.
Yeah, a sequel, see, because you also have second books, which, you know, the sophomore book, which is all, you know, it's not a sequel, but it has that sort of expectation. And those I can think of ones that were just as good, but actually a sequel, a continuation, that's tougher.
I know that Bret Easton Ellis actually, I guess he was just in town, I think at the downtown
yeah.
Powell's maybe, because he wrote ill-advisedly, and this is like, why don't they ask me? Because I could have told them this. He wrote this sequel to Less Than Zero, which I suspect, I don't know this, but my guess would be that somebody's been asking that guy to sequelize Less Than Zero like since the day it came out, and he probably has resisted. And he resisted, they resisted an Eagles reunion, which is until they needed the money quite enough, and somebody wrote enough zeros on the check, and he went, fine, why not? And so he wrote another book named after another Elvis Costello right. song about the same characters. And apparently, I did not see this. I was not there. I don't know if you were, but I'm presuming we've all read Less Than Zero?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And apparently when he was reading from Imperial Bedroom at the Powell's, it was a great, great appearance. But apparently he himself actually said he got like two pages into the reading and he went like, I'm sick of this book. And he just like closed it. I guess he just shut it. And he went, you know, not even I want to read out of this. And he actually closed it and just put it away. And so I always figured that's a guy where they've just ratcheted the money high enough that he went, well, fine, I guess I'll write it. So
I just want to say I'm very excited about the stack of books that you've got there, partly because a couple of these books I've read and really enjoyed myself. And also you have one book there that is the author is a longtime internet friend of mine. And so I'm curious to see what you think of it. Bone Shaker.
I'm really curious about this book. I haven't read it. I've just talked to people about it. And when I started looking at these books that I kind of deemed crossworthy and started talking about it, this one was the one that kind of excited me the most.
So these are books that are these written for kids and then read by adults, or written for adults and read by kids, do you think?
I would say this is written for that young adult market that more and more these days is being picked up by adults. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. But this book especially, I even saved it a little bit deeper in the stack so we could build up to it. But I thought,
we can talk to it now.
Okay, Dawn's ruined that anticipation.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Plunge on ahead.
Okay, well.
I even just mentioned it on the Twitter, and Sherry came back and went, oh, cool, I want to know what he says about it. So she's out there in the ether as we speak.
Well, I started, you know, reading the first chapter and all that sort of thing. And what it is it's kind of a steampunk world that is in Seattle in the 1870s and involves the extraction of gold, Klondike gold rush gone horribly awry in Seattle, leading to what, the expulsion of some sort of gas that creates zombies.
Awesome.
Yeah, so you got zombies, you've got Seattle, you've got that whole steampunk, intricate, mechanical world.
You had me at things gone horribly awry.
Yeah.
That really is. That's the way to get me to read a book.
And Seattle is now, in this book, a walled city in the 1870s that, you know, strikes me. I'm just fascinated by this book.
It's a terrific book. Sherry's a really good writer, but she's also one of those authors that I think she really, really hit her stride with this book, and it's just an excellent read.
I'm already making a list of things that you have recommended that I got to read, because I still got to read The Passage, and I got to read Kraken, and I got to read this. I was actually just talking about this with somebody the other day. I was saying, you know what there needs to be? Somebody needs to take the game Risk, and there needs to be like a post-apocalyptic Risk, like The Road as role-playing game, or as traveling, conquering, settling new lands game, but in like modern-day America, after not even just the zombie apocalypse, but like after an apocalypse of some kind. So I am a huge fan. Anything in which everything goes wrong is a book that I will. Can you just hand that to me so I can pour through?
And it is a great cover too. That's one of the great,
beautiful,
great eye-catching covers. But yes, sort of a steampunk alternate history with zombies.
I swear to God, I'm going to read. Here's just the quote on the front. This is by Sherry Priest. It's called Bone Shaker. And is this? Now it actually says. It actually says sci-fi on the front. It has the sci-fi logo, the sci-fi network logo. So I wonder if this is actually some cross-branding thing with them. It is called, this is a quote on the front from Scott Westerfield, says, a steampunk zombie airship adventure, which is like, I mean, what else do you need to know, really? I mean, that kind of tells, ooh, hey, look at that. And I'm actually flipping through, ooh, Yanni. I'm flipping through the book right now, and I'm so easily marketed to. I'm such a tool. I'm not saying it's not a good book, Sherry. I'm sure it certainly is. It's probably a fine read, but that's not important because it's a zombie airship adventure, and it's like when I picked up Survivor by Chuck Palahniuk, a book that I was ultimately not very happy to have read. I just thought about other things I could have done with my life. But I was sucked in by the fact that the page numbers run backward in that book. It starts at page 248 or whatever, and it goes to zero, which is when the plane crashes. Spoiler. Also, there's a mysterious girl, and plus there's pop culture references and factoids.
And icky sex.
And at one point during the book, this Chuck Palahniuk book, you'll never guess, he makes his living doing something strange that nobody else would have thought of, but it's a bizarre, very edgy occupation in which he manipulates one of mankind's predilections or weaknesses in order to finance a quest that has what turns out to be a spiritual element to it. It's the most amazing Chuck Palahniuk book. But this book, it's not... Even the look of this book, it's got this off-white paper, and then it's got what sounds like it would be very off-putting. It's got brown text, and it actually is just beautiful in a sort of strangely simplistic way. So, excellent. I'm totally going to read that. All right, Bone Shaker. And so zombies in Seattle, presumably everywhere.
Well, Seattle is where the outbreak is taking place, and that's one thing that really also drew me in is the fact that, you know, normally this cool stuff happens somewhere else, but I can identify with Seattle. You know, normally if you go steampunk, it's in London.
Right.
And there's you know, Sherlock Holmes and Jules Verne and all that sort of stuff. But this is in our area of the woods, and I think that's kind of neat.
Awesome. What else have we that adults are reading?
Looking Glass Wars, a number of people I work with just said, oh, no, you just have to look at this. And what it is it's... very much a recasting of Alice in Wonderland, only what the premise behind this is that Alice comes from Wonderland after some pretty major stuff has gone down, and she is in our world. And Wonderland is, she speaks to high heaven about the whole place. You can't believe what happened to me. No one believes her. They practically think she's nuts. The only one that does believe her is... Reverend Dodson, who is Lewis Carroll, and he turns it into a kid's book, and she's pretty put off by it. So basically the whole idea is that you take the framework of Alice in Wonderland and you build something that Lewis Carroll basically supposedly prettified it.
Wow. Okay, so this is it reminds me of something else, and I can't quite put my finger on it.
Probably Wicked.
Well, Wicked, it's that and the sort of inversion of reality in fiction. But there was something else, something that I watched. It was a book I read, something that was sort of like this, where it is the real thing, which is then taken and turned into a fictional version of itself, which then gains traction in the wider world, et cetera. And it was then one of those weird meta, like, Escher painting kind of a things where you can't quite figure out where you are. So the premise is that Alice in Wonderland really happens to the girl who then tells Reverend Dodson, who then writes it. as a book.
Yeah, and then she's quite upset with the fact that, you know, what's all this weird verses? What's
right.
all of this? I mean, this really happened to me. You've ruined it.
Wow. Here's a question. Does an author have to get permission from, like, Lewis Carroll's estate or something to write this weird alternate universe telling of the Alice in Wonderland tale, do you think?
It does make you wonder. I don't know if maybe by now it's public domain. And once again, this would be, you know, I'm sure Lewis Carroll's estate would be in England. Maybe this is written in the U.S. I don't know. I'm not all that up on the copyright rules.
It's interesting because there's one of those. Didn't that happen with we were talking about sequels earlier. Didn't it happen with the Gone with the Wind thing? It wasn't the sequel, but it was that. It was Gone with the Wind as told from the point of view of one of Scarlett's servants. It was like her maid or somebody. It was called The Wind Done Gone, and it was a satiric, and it was a take of, like, as opposed to what it was like to be Scarlett O'Hara, what it was like to be black at
right.
that time. And from that perspective, and of course her estate just went like bonkers and just filed just a raft of lawsuits to try to stop it. And I don't think they ever did, though. I think it came out because it was viewed as being like satire or parody or something. We're talking with Dan Hanico from Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing about the books for kids or young adults that grown-ups like as well. So on the front of the front of Bone Shaker, this guy Scott Westerfeld is quoted, and then I see that actually there's a book by him directly underneath Looking Glass Wars.
Right. This is he has a series, and the first one's called Uglies, and then there's Pretties, and I think he has a couple more out now. This basically kind of takes sort of the pressure cooker and wish fulfillment of high school, and puts it into an alternative world where when you're 16. You are basically come of age and are surgically made very pretty and put in, you know, pretty world. And you just kind of, you know, live a pretty life. And it's kind of a vapid existence. It's a nonstop party. And this is a person who's just on the edge of this happening. And she's going over and trying to find a friend in pretty world. And she's going to start seeing the dark side of it. And, you know, really reading a little bit into it, reading the back of it, it almost seems like a cross between, and this is just my take, impression, but 90210 meets Logan's Run.
I wasn't going to say the 90210 thing, but I was going to say it reminded me a little bit of the White Mountain trilogy, which by, and the guy's name is escaping me, but I think they're Canadian, but it was a trilogy of sci-fi books that were sort of popular when I was a kid because they were serialized in comic strip form in Boy's Life, strangely enough, which I read and then I found out they were actual novels. But it's sort of the same thing. And it's like the Logan's Run thing, or there's a Twilight Zone episode called Number 12 Looks Just Like Me that Rod Serling wrote, which is where when you hit the age of 16, you are taken off to a place and all of your flaws are surgically removed and you are buffed to a high shine and perfection. And then there is the rogue, the rebel who does not want to, who sees the dark side
Sounds
of it, doesn't
like
have
it
take
actually.
Place. I think it's a sort of an archetype that is, you know, that is such a powerful metaphor for adolescence and for the transformation into adulthood that people really latch onto it. So is this part of a series?
Yeah, this is the first of a series that gets a lot of traction. And, you know, you see it's sort of the same sort of thing you see with Twilight. You see a lot of younger women reading it, and then you see a lot of women in their 30s and 40s. And then
right.
now I'm reading it.
Is that – let me ask you this. We talked so much about books that are written for teens or children and they become popular with adults, especially like the young adult books. They talk about that being a new phenomenon, but maybe it seems like that is a phenomenon for female readers more so than men, because it seems like men cling on to their childhood and their adolescence in many, many, many ways a lot longer than women. It seems like women mature and then they kind of stay mature, whereas guys have to be dragged like kicking and screaming, you know, from their spotty teenage years. But as part of that, I think maybe guys cling on to things that they read in adolescence a lot longer. So maybe this is just, from your perspective, just at Powell's, is it a phenomenon in general that's new, or is it just with specific kinds of readers?
Well, this kind of ties into it, because I kind of started thinking, why is it that these books leap? And I was thinking one of the things that might be is this young adult genre tends to maybe free an author up from the expectations of the genre, which then, you know, you kind of tie it into the guys, you know, science fiction, especially fantasy. Well, you've got to have a wizard and you've got to have, you know, I mean, think Sword of Shannara. Whereas these books kind of turn a lot of things, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff is pretty original and you can't see it easily sold to a publisher who's going to say, I need a regular mystery. I need a regular sci-fi. And so maybe it's something like that. It does seem to me that you're right on the fact that this stuff is being picked up more by the females when you think of Twilight and Harry Potter at first, although it became universal.
I'd like to just kind of piggyback on what he's saying, though. I've found myself over the last few years reading more and more young adult novels. And I have a monthly book club that I take part in. One of the guys, Josh, at the book club, we talk a lot about the young adult books. My husband does the same thing. He'll go to the book, to a bookstore, to the library, and he'll end up bringing home a couple of young adult books. And the thing is that the publishing industry for adult fiction seems to have gotten really, really niche-oriented. It's you've got your literary fiction, and then everything else is really strict genre. And genre fiction tends to be very much to a template. Whereas so many of the young adult books, they cross genres. You've got mysteries that are fantasies. Right. You've got science fiction that also has romance, you know, aspects of it. And there is just, and the thing is, they're not written in a way that is not adult anymore. They're not written in a more sophomoric way. They're not written down to a younger audience in any way. The only real difference seems to be that they tend to be a little bit shorter in length. And yeah, and the stories are honestly in so many ways fresher and more original. And I read Uglies. I haven't read the other. The next one is Pretties, and the third one in the trilogy is called The Special. It's called Specials. But Uglies is an excellent book. Another young adult series, Hunger Games, and the sequels to Hunger Games. Just extraordinarily good sort of sci-fi suspense books. And they're just really good reading, and they keep marketing them as young adult books. But really, the reason they're crossing over is because they're good storytelling.
You know, it sort of reminds me how there was that belief for a long time that motion pictures, that movies, was where you went when you were really talented and when you were a name, and that television was for people who were either not good enough yet to make it in the movies, or they had made it in the movies and they had fallen off, and so then they were stuck on television. And over the last 15 years, you know, we've entered a real golden age of television where some of the best writing and acting, some of the best content is being created for television. And it seems like it's that way with a lot of media, where what is initially sort of ghettoized as a place, where you go if you can't make enough money for the company, or if you don't sell enough copies, if you don't have enough viewers, you get stuck there. And then that's where these sort of creative tide pools spring up. Just like, you know, it used to be the case that that if you were a pop songwriter and you couldn't make it in the top 40 world, you had to go write country songs. And then, of course, over time, that just means that you get this incredible bastion of talent there that starts cranking these things out. Leaving Twilight aside, what is the genesis of, like, because I'm trying to remember if young adult novels existed when I was, like, you know, a young adult. And all I remember is The Outsiders. That's like the only thing I can come up with.
I think that would be, yeah. That's...
Yeah, and I remember there being teenage books when I was a kid. And at the library, I remember being like probably about 9 and reading these books in the teenager section of the library.
Like what?
But they were all from like the 50s and the early 60s. So they were about like girls going to the sock hop. So they really didn't – there were nothing I could really relate to in any way. But yeah, that stuff has always existed.
I'm trying
to remember. It's never existed with the sophistication that it does now. And I wonder if it's not just because in the publishing industry there's so much of an expectation that novels, mainstream novels, and things that go into hardcover have to make, you know, so much money.
Right.
Whereas the young adult books, I think they have – originally, they may have shorter print runs. They all go out straight in like paperback, usually the trade paperbacks, which is what most of these are. And I think that the expectation isn't that they're going to be like, sell millions of copies. But sometimes they do.
The other thing that I would say is, and I'm looking here at the books you got, which are, and somebody, the last time you were on, I got several emails criticizing me for not putting up, listing the books on the site with links. So I will do that, actually, because I always get a lot of, you know, what was that book that he mentioned that had the thing with the guy? But you've got Bone Shaker, Looking Glass Wars, Uglies, and then we'll get to, there's two more that I want to get to, Book Thief and Lightning Thief. But That was my point. Oh, but they all have this sort of a, to some degree, a lot of them have a fantasticality to them. And I want to say straight out sci-fi, but they're all, there's some element of adventure or an otherworldliness to them. And I wonder if part of this is, God, could this be a wankier show? This, could I just be more looking into my own navel, you know? But I wonder if part of this is that as the culture evolves and progresses and as things like horror and sci-fi and the influence of comic books and television and fantasy become more and more entrenched and more of an adult thing, you then have more authors writing fantasy, sci-fi, horror, and whatever than there are slots in the adult publishing world. And so just naturally, the way that it happens is that some of those authors passively or actively get shunted off to the young adult section because it's just you know, because like in a post sort of Michael Crichton world, you know, it is no longer a novelty when there is a grown up novel, a novel for adults that is also compelling and entertaining, and that also happens to deal with, you know, science fiction or dinosaurs. And so as a result, the spillover and the influence of that is that it trickles down into the young adult market. So. All I know is that I always miss my unemployment when I get a gig because then I miss the massive amount of reading that I get done. You have The Book Thief there, which I almost bought when I was in New York last with my wife. I saw that there was a guy selling outside the Strand, and the Strand is a bookstore in New York that advertises itself as being 18 miles of books, and I will say that it's not nearly as great as Powell's, but it's got the one thing that I like in a bookstore, or one of the things, and I think we all know the joy of a bookstore here, but specifically the cramped,
exactly,
overflowing bookstore where it feels like the things are about to fall, the stacks are going to fall on you. And it's like it's like the teetering towers of books that are going to smother you. They had The Book Thief on a table outside, and I almost bought it, and I didn't, which I sort of regret. Tell me a little bit about The Book Thief. Give me an overview.
Well, this is, you know, once again, you really have to put aside any idea that this is written for a child. Because, you know, I mean, it might have been.
Well, first of all, it's like 300 pages long. I mean, I'm
yeah,
looking at it.
Yeah, but I mean, the narrator is the Angel of Death. And it's during World War II, during the Holocaust. And the Angel of Death's busy. And it's, you know, right there, you've got some heavy themes running through
right.
this book. And yet it's done with this sort of deft wit about it. You know, I mean, it's sort of, well, like for example, the devil in the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. He's
right.
a man of wealth of taste.
Right.
It's that same sort of, you know, you've got this job, everybody's afraid of you, you've done it a long time, you're good at it, and you've seen it all, you're a little wan, and that persona is kind of in this book just starting off, but then there's also this sort of sadness and this grief and this, you know, what is going on in World War II is outside of your control even. And you see somebody, and this is the Angel of Death, he sees somebody that all of a sudden he likes her moxie. He likes the fact that she is doing some things that, you know, most of the people on this mortal coil aren't doing. And that's why he focuses on her.
It sort of seems like it's a variation on the kind of Screwtape Letters you know, theme, where it's, you know, the observation of humanity by extra humanity, extra
yeah.
human forces, by supernatural forces.
Well, it's also a really terrific book in that it brings you into the experience of being someone in Nazi Germany during World War II, and it pulls you into it because you are seeing this basically through the story of a little girl.
Well,
it's just marvelously done. It's really an amazingly good book.
I'm halfway through it. I've been reading this book, you know, for about a month now with all these other ones I'm juggling, and I'm just like, wow, this is amazing stuff.
Well, and it's another one of those things where, and there's no way to, I don't mean this how it sounds. There's no way to say this where you don't just sound like an ass, but I'm sort of used to that. So I just have to just roll with me on this. It all makes sense at the end. It's like when we were talking about Mouse, the comic, the graphic novel, which depicts the Holocaust by using animals instead of humans. And in a way that you suddenly, you sort of see it anew, which is a cliche, but it's very true. You know, I think for a lot of people, especially for young people, it's like the only image of living in the Holocaust they ever get is Anne Frank, which is certainly a literally true portrait of one facet of that. But it is only one facet, and it's a thing that you are exposed to so early on and then so frequently in childhood that it almost loses meaning. It gets bleached out over time because it's so overexposed, and you don't really ever get a sense to appreciate it on your own or to see it anew. And so I like things that show me stuff in a different way or that allow me to rediscover or get a different take on something that I have only ever seen depicted through a very finite number of channels. So I almost bought that. This is why I regret it, because it just – I talked to the guy at the Strand, too. I'm like, book thief. And he's like, book thief, get it now. And he all but commanded me to buy it. And then I think I just had no more room. I think my bag was just overflowing with crap, and I just had no more room for it.
One thing, mentioning that about it being a little girl, though, I haven't read – what's the one under the book thief?
Lightning Thief?
I haven't read the Lightning Thief, but all of these books, unless the Lightning Thief is differently – the main characters are girls. And I think that will be one reason why you'll find so many young women reading young adult novels, is that the preponderance of them have female protagonists. And whether or not, again, the industry seems to feed itself, you know, it's like, well, you know, we can't sell books with male main characters, so therefore we don't publish books with male main characters. Because we can't sell them,
right.
So we don't publish them.
Right.
Because a friend of ours, Mr. David Walker, has, and he's talked about this on the air, so I'm not giving away any secrets. He's written a young adult novel, and he's trying to get it published, and he's been told several times that the main problem with it is that the main character's a boy, and that publishers don't want that.
Wow.
young adult, and they say, and he's actually been told that boys don't read as many books as girls do. And he's like, well, maybe if there were more books with boys as the main characters, and it seems to be sort of thing that's feeding that's feeding itself.
And it just becomes that thing too where it is the person, I think, so often that makes that decision is just basing it on the information that was true like 20 years ago when they were on the front line at the publishing house dealing with audiences or dealing with taste at that time. And it might not even have been true then, but it's just that they are in such a removed, isolated bubble that they have no idea. Not like I do. I mean, I'm 37. What the hell do I know? But they just don't really have any idea how young people behave in this case, or young boys or young girls. Before we finish this up, before we do this last book here, and I had some other like big wanky point that I was going to make about books and reading and something, and it's gone to me now. But if you've said to yourself, if you've wondered aloud, my God, what a fine radio program this is, and how refreshing and delightful it is that I'm able to hear a radio program in which the world of books is picked up and embraced wholeheartedly, like one might embrace, Dawn.
What's the thing you embrace?
Puppies.
There you go, like puppies. I sounded like Chuck Woolery there. Things you embrace. Your uncle.
Come on.
In any event, if you've asked yourself, my God, how is this program available to me for the low, low cost of only 32 cents a day? It seems like a thing that defies logic. It defies probability. I don't understand, Rick Emerson, mathematically speaking, how the numbers even work. How is it that you can do this? What law of God are you violating? It really is. It's because of folks like Michael Beatty. He is the proprietor of The Cleaning Solution, locally owned and operated business, and in many ways, actually, here in Portland. His supplies, chemicals, equipment, all of that stuff, that comes from Portland businesses whenever possible. He actually supplies himself from other Portland companies. And, of course, when it comes time for him to advertise to the good people of our fair metropolis, where does he come? The Rick Emerson Show. So you ought to contact him at this number. I'm going to give it to you right now, and here's the thing. I'm going to give it to you right now, and you're going to say, well, Rick, this is all well and good in theory, in the abstract, I suppose, if there's some sort of, explanatory purpose. But I don't have a stain. And the thing is, you may look down at your rug and you say, my rug is fine. Your rug is fine today. Your rug is fine maybe tomorrow. As Dan Hanico from Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing, as a one-year-old child, will tell you, your rug may not be fine next month. Or maybe even later this evening. One never knows when those carrots are going to come back up. You know what I'm saying? So you write it down, have it around. Even if you don't use it today, let's be honest, you're going to need something cleaned on your floor at some point. It's just a matter. That's a statistical fact. So you write this down. It's 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Because if you don't do that, what's going to happen is it's going to be the night of like your book club. Like my wife, have I told you about Lara? She wants to form this, and it was after reading Fools Rush In by Bill Carter, who also wrote Red Summer, and we had him on the show. And she read two things in a row. She read Where Men Win Glory, which is the new Jonathan Krakauer book about Pat Tillman, which is just unfreaking believable, which is unbelievably good. And then she read Fools Rush In. And so she says to me as she's finishing this Bill Carter book, about whom, by the way, I already feel insecure because he's like, you know, he went to Sarajevo and like has Bono on speed dial and he made a movie and he's an Alaskan fisherman. She finishes the book and she puts it down. And she goes, yeah, I want to start an Authors I Want to F book club. And then I thought, well, that's an amusing one-liner. And then I look at her. She doesn't hear that because she's already on the phone to her friends trying to get them together like next Wednesday for said book club. So if you get invited to my house, it's because my wife wants to have like some sort of a ladies' book club centered around authors that she wants to have sexual relations with. So that doesn't make me feel weird. The point is that if you got some big stain in your living room rug, something I can help you with over there?
No.
Chatty Cathy?
I'm just enjoying your segues.
Yeah. Well, the point is, if you want your house to be clean so other, you know, enthusiasts of literature can come over and talk about authors that they want to have hot sex with, you know, you call The Cleaning Solution, 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211, The Cleaning Solution, a proud supporter and sponsor of the Rick Emerson radio program. All right, so there we go. So there's that. And I'm not making that up, by the way. All right, so the final book here, we're talking with Dan Hanico from Powell's Books, Cedar Hills Crossing, The Lightning Thief. Is that the thing that just made into a movie?
Well, you see, this is kind of the exception that proves the rule of what Don was just saying. This one, I've just stayed away because it just seemed a little bit too Harry Potter
right,
to me.
Right, right.
And I've kind of given it a second chance when I was looking for these titles, and even its first, I don't know, first sentence makes you think about Harry Potter. But once you go into the second, third, and fourth sentence, it's very immediate, very one first person, which is oftentimes, you know, kind of scarce in this sort of thing. And it just kind of grabbed me. Also, like what Cheryl was saying outside, they just made a movie of it, and she said it was a grave disappointment.
Yeah, apparently it was a disaster. Well, and I got to tell you, as shallow as this sounds, I got put off by it when it had a different cover last year because the cover, it was like a full-on steal from Harry Potter. It had like the jagged lightning bolt thing, and I was like, F that book.
As was all the advertising for the film.
Yeah, and I was just like completely without any other evidence. I dismissed it. Like,
and that's
dick.
Kind of what so, I did. Yeah. I was thinking, okay, it's Harry Potter again. And then the movie, that didn't look good. But pick it up and read it, and it has a whole different feel.
Awesome. All right, so just to recap, and I'll put these on the website later on the day, the books we talked about were Bone Shaker, The Looking Glass Wars, The Book Thief, and The Lightning Thief, as well as a book called Uglies by Scott Westerfeld. So, all right, awesome, fantastic. We have to do the top five tomorrow. There's just no
and
time.
And the Clown Watch and the Penis Watch. Well, the Job Watch. We have so many things that we didn't do today.
We owe it to the people to do a watch. Dan, you're the guest. Would you like to have a Job Watch, a Penis Watch, or a Clown Watch? It's your choice.
I'm going to go with the Penis Watch.
All right. Ladies,
you knew
and,
I would.
That was going to be my guess, but I didn't want to presume. Well, we'll do this, then we'll get ready to wrap it up. Greg and Sarah are going to get in here for Fun Employment Radio, which tapes in here next. You can find that at funemploymentradio.com. Tomorrow, our guests will include Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Without further ado, here's your Penis Watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson Radio program.
Take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a-melting away. Bow, 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 I take a look at my enormous penis. Santa, everything is going my way.
Here's Don Taylor with your Penis Watch for Wednesday.
Brett Favre may have sent penis pictures to model Jen Sturger.
Well done.
According to an article at the website Deadspin. The site reports that 26-year-old Sturger, a former columnist for Sports Illustrated's website, who is no stranger to revealing photo shoots, says the legendary quarterback flirted with her when they were both employed by the New York Jets. According to the article, Sturger claims that Favre, who has reportedly been is fond of texting his teammates, texted her something quite different. Numerous photos of his penis, including one in which, quote, he's masturbating while wearing a pair of Crocs. While the report lacks any hard evidence, it would hardly be the first time that Deadspin posted
hard
photographs
evidence.
Of naked athletes. You can go to deadspin.com and check that out.
Let me just ask you this, Don. As
yes.
Don, as a Muslim, why... numerous photos of the penis.
Mm-hmm.
As a woman... if it's one guy we're talking about, It seems like that is a, as with so many things, that's a binary. That's an on-off position there. There's a middle ground. But, I mean, there's really two states the penis can be in. Mm-hmm. Do you need multiple photographs?
Here's my theory. Because I've thought about this quite a bit, because I remember being curious as to why gentlemen would put photographs of their penis on, like, say, their Craigslist postings when they're looking for women to go out with them on dates.
Yes.
Because most women do not, like, look at a picture of a penis and go, hurrah, a penis, I am now aroused and want to date you.
I had no idea where to get one of those.
I think it's a case of men do, as a rule, have that very visual thing where they see breasts, for example, and say, woohoo, breasts, and get very excited and happy to see breasts. Women, not so much. Women do not just look at penises, as a rule, and go, yippee, I'm aroused now. But to the male mind, it's, what can I do to excite this woman?
Right, right.
What would excite me? A photograph of body parts. I will send her a picture of my erect penis. And not really thinking the whole process through about, what would she like?
Yeah.
So,
men don't really ever get to the "what would she actually like" part. Men go, well, this is the same thing that it drives men to go, well, I'll just get her a gift certificate. That's what I'd want. I mean, or cash. How about you, honey? Here's a 50. Happy birthday. Because that's what a guy would like. Yeah. Or perhaps the set of four Kiss rubber ducks. So if you're a woman and then you're perusing the personals ads, mm-hmm. And there's some guy who wants to get with you, if a guy was going to put up a photograph. I mean, the obvious thing is like the face.
Yeah.
But leaving that aside, just saying for you, if for some reason he's not going to post a picture of the face, because a lot of it does seem to focus on the below the neck, what is the other body part? What is the close second, or if there is a second?
For
anyway?
Me personally, yeah. I'm fond of the upper arm.
Like the bicep?
Yeah.
All right. Sort of in flexing mode or just sort of
relaxed? I like a well-formed upper arm. This is, I think, one of the reasons why I dated a lot of drummers when I was young. That and I like guys with big noses. And drummers always had big noses as well. So.
And you just don't spend enough time bailing people out of jail, apparently.
That too. But no, I know a lot of women that seem to find men's butts appealing. And that's something that has never really done anything for me.
I don't – this is a longer conversation we have time for. Okay, I'm going to ask. I'm just going to put this out there because here's the thing: if I say we'll get to this tomorrow, it's never going to be gotten to.
I will make sure we get to this tomorrow, whatever
really?
It is. I will make sure we talk.
Okay,
about
but
it. Whatever you're about to bring to the table.
Okay, but you have to swear to God. You have to
swear. I'll even write it on the board, and I swear we will talk about it.
Here's you have to swear two things. One, mm-hmm. you have to swear that you will make us get to this tomorrow. You make me talk about this. But B, you will have to. Swear on a thing of great. Swear on the talking Dennis Miller doll.
I swear on Buddy Jesus.
Thank you. That make me get to this before Anna Griffin gets here. Because otherwise, it's just going to be. It's going to be very awkward.
Yeah.
In like many
top
ways.
Of the show. We will get to whatever this is. So what is your query?
No. See, because I can't tell you now.
Oh, you just want to get back to the... Oh, okay.
I can't... If I tell you the query now, then it's like... I will not
be
able to...
It'll be all spoiled tomorrow?
Yeah.
It'll be fresh?
I won't be able to put that genie back in the jar.
Okay.
Or wherever it is the genie comes from. So, all right. What were we doing?
We had a penis watch.
No, and now it's over. There you go. There's your penis watch.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start...
Brett Favre, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
I'm never quite sure how to pronounce his name either because it's Favre.
Yeah.
But it's pronounced apparently Favre.
Favre. That doesn't make any sense. And that implies that he had multiple pictures of his penis, just like, sitting
numerous,
around.
Numerous, it says.
I mean, is there are there any indications that it's a penis of which he should be exceptionally proud?
And, no, I don't know. I'm just kind of taken aback by the fact that he was wearing Crocs.
Oh, yeah. No, that's... Well, first of all...
That seems unlikely.
Is there a photograph of the chick?
Yeah.
Let me see.
Well, she's...
Let me see if that's a girl you'd send your penis to. I mean, photographically. Well, yeah, she's cute in a way that suggests not too much personality. All right, well, fine. The final thing about Crocs is that I was at a baby shower this last Saturday, and it wasn't because I was being punished. It was quite the opposite. I have now paid my dues for the next 4 weeks or four social engagements, and so the next four things Laura goes to, I don't have to go to. I got like a get-out-of-party-free card for like the next four things. But baby shower came up, baby shower I went to. And so it's the whole thing of like, you know, they're going, she's opening the gifts or whatever. And it's all, and it's a bunch of grown, you know, men and women cooing and going, ah. And I don't mean any disrespect, Dan. I know you have a kid and all. But it's that thing of like, well, it's that human thing. And I don't think it's just an American thing. I think it is a human thing where you love something because it's a much smaller version of something that you wouldn't care about if it were normal sized. You know?
Well, sure. And babies have those big heads and the big eyes and the things that we're hardwired to find adorable.
Well, because she's like, taking the new. And at some point, I don't know when we passed this line of demarcation where we no longer use boxes. Everything came in a sack with tissue. There's like some Randolph Hearst conspiracy. They were like a tissue concern somewhere, decided to push for that. So she's taking out the tissue. And then she takes out, oh, look, it's a pair of Skechers, but they're smaller than normal. And so everyone goes, oh, look at the thing that's smaller than it ought to be. Whatever. So she goes through all of this. And so the woman who bought her the Skechers says, you know, I looked all weekend long and I could not find what I really wanted. She said, without a trace of irony, which was Crocs. She was all upset that she couldn't find Crocs for the kid. And I was just thinking a silent, you know, prayer to myself that child grows up and you know, has a life that passes for normal. You're surrounded by people who tried to dress you in Crocs as a baby when you could not fight back or punch successfully to stop it. It just seems wrong. It's wrong. Don't put Crocs on your child, Dan. Please. I'm just saying. You shouldn't do these things. It's awful. It's bad. All right. Dan Hanico, Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing, located at the intersection of Cedar Hills Boulevard and Hall. Bam! That's what I'm talking about. Don Taylor, final thoughts for today? Maybe a last observation about the works of Gallagher?
Nope. I'm just waiting for us to be done with it because I have to sprint across town to go do Ham-Fisted Radio.
Where can that be heard?
That can be heard on PDX FM today at 4 p.m.
Fantastic.
Or downloadable at hamfistedradio.com.
Zing. All right, there you go. Don't forget, this program is available on iTunes. It's also archived at rickemerson.com. Did you just make a noise?
I did. I made a little hicky noise.
Okay.
Sorry.
Also, we have redesigned rickemerson.com. So if you go there and it looks all wonky, it's not your eyes that have gone bad. Actually, it is your eyes. I haven't changed anything. It's you.
And supposedly the mobile stream is all fixed, except someone said in the text box earlier that it was wonky again a little bit today. So.
You know what? That's just a tumor pressing against your aural nerves, sir. I hate to be the one to tell you that, but look, if you don't hear from me, you're going to get it on the street. In any event, we want to thank our guest Dan Hanico from Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing, the intersection of Cedar Hills Boulevard and Hall. Also, Aaron Mesh from Alignment Week. Join us tomorrow when I will talk about men's buttocks. Also, Anna Griffin for the Oregonian will be here. It's just two things that just don't seem to. Anyway, thank you all for being out there. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you today and every day from the studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milk packing district here in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. Our chief of staff is Cheryl Kennecoa. Advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill. Executive producer Bruce Agler. And at the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor. As always, the Rick Emerson Show is sponsored and made possible by a generous grant from you. Thank you for being out there. It is Wednesday, August 4th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, my name is Rick Emerson. Thank you all for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now. Watch out for snakes.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.